Welcome to The Loins of History. My name is Jay, and I'm joined by my co-host, Colin. And we are on our third and final episode of our history of the downfall of the Roman Empire. We are doing a podcast series on cultural and civilizational collapse. We are a podcast that desires to connect history to current events and correct political and historical illiteracy. And we believe that history actually has something to say about the present, and that it's more or less pointless to study the past if it doesn't connect to what's going on today. And with this series on civilizational collapse, cultural decline, we wanted to look at different empires: the Roman Empire, the Han Dynasty, the French Third Republic, Antebellum South,
dynasties, empires,
right, above. Right, these civilizations, and just kind of ask some questions like, what led to their downfall, and what can we learn from that and apply it to today? So this episode, Colin is going to talk to us about the fall of Roman culture. So with Colin, what you got?
Thanks, Jay. I think this is going to be our favorite of the three that, yes, we talked about with Rome. It's
very excited.
It has the most similarity to today. You know, the economics is fun because obviously right now the economy is not great. But you know, trying to transliterate Roman economy to today's economy, you know, the military episode, it was very black and white. This one, there's a lot of discussion around like a return to a traditional type of civilization.
Yeah.
And so, that's entered the modern discourse right now. And I think it's funny because that is not like an original like desire for man. It's happened so many times over. And that's actually the first key takeaway, that this recurring theme of like a return to tradition, or a return to when men were men and when civilization was great and were built on all of these great ideals and fundamentals, like, that is not only something that has happened throughout history of this return, yeah, to Rome, but it happened within the Roman Empire. So like right, within Rome itself, that was something that was desired. And it's not surprising. Like, Rome was founded, as I said, in 753 BC, and the Western Roman Empire fell in 476. That's 1,100 years where culture shifted dramatically from beginning to end. And, you know, just after Rome, you know, people tried to copy and return to this ideal of Rome, of, you know, this legendary civilization. You know, there was the Holy Roman Empire, there's the Czars, there's Kaiser, there's, if you look at any of the architecture in Washington, D.C., it's a Roman-esque, yeah, type of, you know, we, yep, you know, the eagle, like, we have a bald eagle, the Germans had an eagle as well. The French Napoleon, he had an eagle standard. Like, it's always, mm-hmm, kind of calling back to Rome. But it's interesting that even Rome called back to an early version of itself. And then key takeaway number two, Christianity, if you've ever read like Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Western Roman Empire, which is fantastic, great series. It's six books, so it might take you a little while, but he really puts a lot of the blame on Christianity for the fall of Rome and kind of a jettisoning of Roman values. I think that's actually very true, but I do want to make the distinction that it is a separation from Roman culture. It's not so much part of the decline or part of the cultural decay so much as it is a separation. And it kind of left what was left of Rome to its own devices and rot. And then finally, I personally believe, and I'm going to try and make the case as best I can over the next 50 or so minutes, that the culture really set the stage for all of the other factors in Rome's decline to occur. So, you know, the culture rot, you know, the corruption, the civil wars, the bad economy, all of these things were able to happen because you had a pandemic of cultural rot and decay. And that's what set the stage for it. And I think that that is what allowed those things to happen continuously and not allow Rome to recover like it did during the Republic. As I mentioned last week, there was a time when Rome was knocked in the teeth during the Republic, but it was able to recover and come back stronger. Whereas in the late Roman Empire, it just couldn't. Right. So Those are the key takeaways for today.
Real quick, just again, I feel like I say this a lot. I hope this doesn't derail you from what you're trying to say. But can you just, so we're all on the same page here, what is your definition of culture? Dude, shoot from the hip, man. This is our, it doesn't matter.
The manifestation of a shared identity through, through arts, through customs, through traditions, through, I think it is all predicated on that shared experience and that shared identity, and it just manifests itself outwardly. Yeah, what do you think of that?
The expression of a shared identity. I like that. Because there's so many tangible ways, you know, the NFL, right? Mm-hmm. The NFL and American football is a huge part of American culture. Like, it's the biggest sport, right, in the United States. And like, it's a game, but yet so many people wrap up their identity in that whole thing. Like, I am a Packers fan. I am a Patriots fan. Like, I love Patrick Mahomes. Like, the, you name it, like, these people like wrap themselves up in that, and the expression of that, I think it's safe to call that culture. So yeah, I like,
you know, I'm gonna say that is like a quasi culture or a farce of culture, because I would argue that over the past like 40 years that the United States really has lacked a true culture outside of just generic consumerism. And I sound like such a hippie saying that. I sound like such a hippie saying that, but like, to your point about like football, I think there are elements of culture, especially like football in like the 50s and the 60s. Like, it was, there's some old like documentaries on like football getting started in kind of the South, and it was really rooted in like just a living in like a tougher environment of like the South. And it was sort of just, football was a byproduct, and the way that they played was a byproduct of the culture writ large. Now, like, being a fan of like the Dolphins, I'm a Dolphins fan, being a fan of the Dolphins, that's just kind of like saying I have some identity. And I think it's because innately people want to have an identity. They want to identify with something. And without like a truly dominant culture, you're going to just default to some team or some clique or whatever. But no, I would argue that I think American culture has just kind of been, I don't know, hijacked into just whatever's popular and whatever sells. Unfortunately, I don't think we have something genuine and authentic anymore.
See, this is interesting, Colin, because in a sense, I think you're right. However, I don't know if I would say it's like a farce. Like, just because we may not like it doesn't mean it's like not true, or not even ideal. You know, even bringing this back into Rome, like, and I think don't let me steal thunder or anything like that, but like, we get these cultural divisions because there's aspects of the culture that significant groups within the culture, they don't like it. So they ostracize. And, you know, in an earlier episode, it's when the society begins caving in on itself and begins like tearing in on itself that you get these divides. Take, for example, LGBT type stuff, right? Should I not go there? I know. I think I can go there in a helpful way. Like, it's not a surprise that like you will find two different categories of people, at least, who are extremely pro LGBT and then extremely anti LGBT, right? If you were to ask like which one was culture and which one was anti-culture, like, you would get opposite answers. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's an example of where like, it's part of the culture that nobody, that either side disagrees with. And like, again, I think this is applicable when you see the Romans were actually doing this exact same thing.
I sound like Edward Gibbon, like just waxing poetic about like the fall of culture in Rome, but putting that on American society. But I think a lot of those things are just kind of shallow, like, you know, mimic, you know, it's like a mimic of a real culture that people, they seek a culture, they seek an identity. And then in the absence of one, they'll put on a shell of like, hey, it's my football team. That's all I got. I'm going to go paint my face and spend $400 on a ticket on Sunday to go see a game. and maybe I'm being harsh, but I think those things should be byproducts of a culture writ large. And I think in many ways they used to be, and we have lost sight of that and are now treating them as culture themselves versus a byproduct of a overarching culture. So that's just
Colin,
my take.
It's because we both are from states that don't have good football teams. That's why you're saying that.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm in SEC country. Talk about culture right there.
SEC country?
SEC.
Wait, SEC team in your state won the national championship?
Well, the ACC team did.
Yeah, exactly. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The SEC team in Collins State here hasn't done jack. It's the ACC team that won a couple national championships, but we digress.
So you got me fired up on something I shouldn't have been fired up on. Anyway. Well, back to Rome. Relaying this all to Rome and the cultural decline of Rome.
Bringing it back to Rome here.
As we do. We like to have fun. You know, as I said, there's this discussion in even internally to Rome of like, what do we need to return to tradition? And what exactly is that? So you can kind of divide Rome. There's a ton of different ways you can divide up chronologically and how you want to. But there's like three main ones. And that's, you can go to the very early part of Roman history with the seven kings. And then there's the Republic. And that was after the last king was forced out and the Republic was established in 509 BC and democracy came to Rome, conveniently 1 year prior to Rome, to democracy being invented in Greece. I think that is done on purpose as Rome rules. And then it transitions from the Roman Republic to the Imperial Rome. Yeah, Rome tends to do that a lot. I'm going to get into that. You know, and so looking at the Roman Republic, I think that is when a lot of Romans living in the imperial era look back on that and look at the values they had in the Roman Republic as the ideal state of Rome. And I don't just mean the actual institution of Rome. I mean the people of Rome, like down to the average Roman citizen.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you were to just kind of sum them up in a few words, it's really they were, you know, a hardy agrarian people. They were prudent and they were patriotic. And that's kind of silly. I know when we say patriotic, you think of like, you know, American patriots cheering for, you know, like post 9/11 America. I mean, like they had a duty to protect Rome and it was viewed as an honor to serve Rome. Like if you're a Roman citizen, it was expected of you to serve in the military in some fashion. So, you know, I think the best example of like an ideal Roman in the Republic. So there's a man named Cincinnatus, of which the city of Cincinnati is named after. And a society of Cincinnatus was founded many centuries later, of which George Washington was a member of. And actually he looked to Cincinnatus as a fine example of what we should look to in our leaders. Cincinnatus was a patrician. So we haven't really gone over the patricians versus plebes, but the patricians were like the aristocracy. They could trace their lineage back to the first Roman senators, post kings of Rome, and the plebes were just everybody else. So he was a patrician, but he lived a simple life. He was but a humble farmer who lived on the outskirts of the city of Rome. And due to his noble birth and general talent that he had, he was called upon to become a dictator twice, actually. And during the Republic, there was a office that was reserved for times of crisis when somebody could become a dictator temporarily to see Rome through the crisis. And during the first time he was the dictator, I think it was the Aquians who were besieging Rome and they were about to overrun a Roman army and just wipe them out. And Rome was in dire straits. And they came to Cincinnatus, or as the story goes, he was plowing his field and they asked him to be the dictator. And he left his plow in the field and became dictator temporarily for 16 days, defeated the Aquians, saved Rome. And then he went back to his farm and picked up the very plow that he dropped and began farming again. That's how the story goes. Both Livy in his Ab Urbe Condita, or History of Rome, he talks about this. And then in Plutarch's Parallel Lives, they both give account to the story. And I think it's interesting. And here's where you can kind of read between the lines in this. Cincinnatus lived in the 5th century BC. So this was prior to the Gauls sacking Rome, and a lot of Roman records were being destroyed. And Livy and Plutarch were writing this right around or shortly after Augustus Caesar. So it was several hundred years later. So they didn't really have the records for sure. And it was prior to, or excuse me, yeah, this was written prior to Rome being sacked. So I tend to think that though Cincinnatus was a dictator, some of the story was a bit apocryphal. And I think it was done for a purpose. I think Livy and Plutarch, who is actually Greek, by the way, wrote this because they wanted to idealize Cincinnatus as this ideal Roman. When they wrote this to the Roman people and to Augustus, who would all be reading it, they wanted to take a man who did great things. I'm sure of that, but they wanted to make him and idealize him as this is what we expect from Romans. This is what we expect from our emperor. This is what we expect from our people. Cincinnatus is the ideal. If we look back to the Republic of Rome, that's what we need to get back to. We need to get back to our roots as a people who were agrarian, who were farmers, who believed in the idea of Rome, who would serve Rome at the drop of a hat. There's also another story that was also probably apocryphal about a man, Gaius Mucius Scaevola, and I probably mispronounced that, but there was a local tribe led by Lars Porsena who came and besieged Rome, and this was right at the founding of the Roman Republic, and I think this, and he went into the camp of Lars Porsena, and he was this great scene where he's standing before him, and he sticks out his hand and puts his hand directly into fire and is burning his hand. And he just looked Lars Porsena dead in the face and basically said, like, this is the bravery and courage that you can expect from every Roman to die for their city, and just watched him in the eyes, you know, as his hand was burning in the fire. Now, again, probably very apocryphal, but it's written because these are the stories that they wanted Romans to aspire to. And I think there's a lot to it. I think that there are grains of truth in there. I think that the Romans of the Republic were much more civically engaged. They were much more frugal. Like there were no bread and circuses, or they were done at a much smaller scale. They were much more responsible fiscally, even at a personal level. They did not, you know, the idea of these like Roman orgies and parties and all these things like that, that was foreign to them at the time. And it would have actually disgusted them, even their leaders. So that was kind of what was going on during the Republic era. And it was something that I think a lot of Romans, especially in the academic and the philosophers and historians, understood was transitioning as Rome became an imperial power and was shifting. They recognized it. And I think that it was kind of their last gasp to reinvigorate this sense of traditionalism. And it's funny because you see this kind of going on right now in the United States. And this isn't so much a commentary on like, should we go back or should we not? There's some merits and demerits to doing both, but I think it is just kind of funny looking at Rome that they had this same kind of conversation that people have now today. It's like, hey, maybe we've gone too far. Maybe the culture needs to take a few steps back and look back to the founders, look back to these different men and women of American history, and that's what we should aspire to be. Maybe a simpler life is better, because right now it seems like the train's getting off the tracks here.
Right. I have had a question for years kind of in my mind. Do you remember back when like libertarianism was like faddish? It was like cool to be a libertarian.
Am I gonna have to rail on libertarians again?
For our listeners who, you know, maybe this is the first episode that you're listening to, but I'll speak for myself. Colin, you can agree or disagree or not. I love to hate on libertarians.
Yeah, I absolutely do too. It's great in theory, but in practice, it falls apart.
And let me be clear here. I love to hate on libertarians from a like friendly, consider them friends. They're like little brothers. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like a lot of libertarians. I think there's value. Like, for example, Cato Institute, right? If you're into think tanks, that seems appropriate for a History of Rome episode. The think tank that is for libertarian views is called the Cato Institute. They do really good work. They produce good stuff. However, have some fundamental issues with the philosophy, the political philosophy behind libertarianism. But when I remember thinking about this question that I have, when libertarianism was like cool and it was like, oh, I'm a libertarian. I believe in like classical liberalism and like all this stuff. And when I began reading up on that, libertarianism in its essence is defined by this principle of non-aggression, right? As long as you're not hurting anybody else, you are free to do whatever you want, right? That's libertarianism. Well, I grew up as self-identifying as a conservative, right? And I thought to myself, what is the fundamental principle of conservatism? Ladies and gentlemen, I currently believe that the fundamental principle behind conservatism is simply a longing for the past. Because from a philosophical standpoint, I don't think that you can get two conservatives to agree on any kind of thing that's even remotely similar to like the principle of non-aggression. Rather, what you generally tend to see is that they wish things are currently like they were in a past time, when in a better past time. And we long for the past. And when, Colin, when you were talking about like Livy and Plutarch, and they kind of like romanticize and idealize these things, it's like American conservatism, you know, George Washington is a saint. Like all of these guys, you know, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Ben Franklin, and it, and, you know, it's hard to cope when you actually look and you see, now, granted, George Washington was a really good dude, but like all of the founding fathers had flaws, you know, a lot, you know, let's not even talk about slavery. Like those, you know, we kind of idealize the past because we see goodness. And I'm not trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Like there was and is goodness. I think it's probably even more wrong to completely throw the pendulum in the opposite direction and say like, you know, these are, you know, they're racist or like these are wicked people. Like that's not true either. But at the same time, like from a logical consistency standpoint, there's something to be said about this just emotional urge to romanticize the past in the hope of using that as a guiding framework for how we should respond to things today.
Gustav Mahler has a great quote, and it's, tradition is not the worship of ashes, but it's the preservation of fire. I think that sums up. Yeah, it's the preservation of fire. And I say that because if you look at, and what I'm about to get into with the late period of Rome, not even late period, just Imperial Rome, the fire seemed to go out. And that's kind of the best way to put it. Like, yeah, to your point, like what actually is conservative? Is like, what are we conserving? Like, are we worshiping people that have died before us? And it's really no. And I think in essence, like Livy wanted to preserve the fire that was Rome and had built Rome and created this great imperial power. What happened over the next 400 years is that fire was slowly quenched. In and of itself, I think Edward Gibbon basically, I don't have the quote right off the top of my head again, but he basically said like Rome collapsed under its own greatness, its own weight. Oh. That's kind of what he makes in and of it, the argument he makes throughout his six volumes. Yeah. I mean, Gibbon has a great quote. I mean, Rome has grown since its humble beginnings that it is now overwhelmed by its own greatness. And so like, what is that greatness that overwhelmed the fire that Livy was trying to preserve?
Yeah. And I think kind of to an earlier point of yours, Colin, like if we look to the past for how we should be approaching things in the future, which, oh, by the way, this is literally our mission statement here at the Loins of History, connecting history to current events. Does that make us fundamentally conservatives?
Yes.
Anyway, right. I think what we... What you have to do, though, is not just simply say the past was inherently better. Rather, you have to define what the actual goodness was in the past. You know, was there some, you know, the Romans were all about virtue, right? And there was this, which they stole from the Greeks, right? Like if you read Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle was known for creating what's called a virtue ethics as a systematic way to approach weal and woe, fault and reward. Like, here are good things, here are bad things, and he put it as virtues. If, without going too far down that rabbit trail, if we look back and we like, okay, were the virtuous things? You mentioned one, Colin, that's worth mentioning again, and that is when the Romans looked back on their culture, they saw agrarianism as a virtuous profession, that there was an inherent ethical good in being a farmer, working the land, having a simple life, like being tied to the land, like that there was this objective goodness that came out of it. And then as Rome urbanized, more and more people got away from that, and they correlated, well, our culture and our society is actually going down because less of us are farmers.
No, that kind of sums up like what Gibbon was trying to say. Like if you look at Imperial Rome, and especially as we start fast forwarding toward the decline, I'll go through some specific examples that Gibbon especially brings out. But like if you think about Republic Rome, like at its height in the Republic, they had just defeated the Greeks. So, I mean, they kind of had like most of the Mediterranean. They had beaten Carthage. They beat the Greeks. You know, they had the Italian peninsula. They had parts of like southern Gaul, France, Spain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they weren't this truly, like, as we said before, like massive empire stretching from Britannia to all the way to Mesopotamia. They weren't there yet. So they're still like a very regional power, and they could still keep that, the essence of an agrarian society, the farmers, and the farmers who serve in the military.
Right.
Late Rome, they became so fabulously wealthy and decadent that, I mean, here's some examples. Like Nero was obviously very bad. Tiberius was another one. Like Roman emperors no longer, like the leaders of Rome were so far removed from that ideal Roman. And that's kind of where it starts. It was like a top-down thing. So like Tiberius, for example, he had like, I can't remember where it was at. I mean, it was basically like a palace. It was like a pleasure palace where he would have like small children swimming around in a pool while he was naked. And he called them his little minnows. It's like, that was the kind of thing that like Roman emperors. Yeah, no, you had Caligula marching on Poseidon and, you know, trying to go fight the ocean. And I think he made his horse the senator, and, you know, Nero was the same way. He had like a pleasure palace, and it started that way, and it just spiraled out of control because they were so fabulously wealthy. So the emperors were doing this, and then the senators, and then everybody who was wealthy in Rome, and it kind of sucked all the elite into it. You know, we say the elite, that's a very modern term, but, you know, it has modern pejorative connotations, but it applies then too. Yeah. So it started sucking them into it. And then, you know, with how big the empire was, it was really hard to truly enforce a lot of these laws. And I just kind of had this thought. People look at harsh laws and harsh enforcement of laws, and they think that's very barbaric. Mm. When in reality, that's just civilized people dealing with barbarians or people that can't be civilized. Mm. Like, it's a policy decision. Rome got so big, it could no longer effectively manage and police itself. It could no longer police the bureaucracy that it needed to survive. And it kind of became cancerous. So like you would have, I mean, let's talk about the mint. We talked about economics on the first episode and kind of go back to that. You're talking about this corruption, this loss of virtue that they had, this frugal virtue. The mint was responsible for debasing the currency because oftentimes they would shave, just take little shavings off, and they would pocket a lot of the change, and they were responsible for taking a lot of that silver out. So that's why later Roman emperors would have to move the mints closer to Rome so they could keep an eye on. But you could no longer police, because what are you going to do? And then you have other administrative offices who were literally selling the office. You know, they're basically putting it up for bid. We talked about it last week with the Praetorian Guard, or 2 weeks ago, the Praetorian Guard going. murdering Pertinax, going out and saying, hey, who wants the purple? Highest bidder.
Right.
You know, and then that guy's killed again. So you just have this cascading effect through the empire where you have now bureaucratic institutions who are responsible for upholding the empire, literally tearing it down because they are siphoning off money from taxes. They are siphoning off money for corruption. They are slowly killing the empire while they are fattening their wallets. This happened. This was rampant throughout the Roman Empire. So, I mean, there was sale of offices, there's tax farming, there's bribery and embezzlement going on everywhere. So if you were a wealthy patrician or a wealthy aristocrat, and let's say you lived in Britannia, it wasn't uncommon for you to go and bribe other local officials in order to get more favorable services or rights for your family. And then nepotism kind of really took over. And then if you wanted to go buy off judges, so this on the ability to enforce the laws that was so ingrained in early Romans was no longer really, didn't really matter because it just came down to who was being bought off and this underlying corruption that eroded the whole system. So when I'm kind of combining one and three, but the key takeaways, but like the economy became bad for a lot of reasons, but it wouldn't have happened so fast. And it would have been, I think, reversible had you had good people in these positions, people that were not, that were above corruption, people that were above, you know, breaking the law because they know that it would A, be enforced fairly, and B, they would never really want to in the first place. You would have Roman emperors who were not in, who didn't want a pleasure palace, but they would almost rather be in the fields plowing like Cincinnatus or, you know, to Diocletian's credit, you know, he gave up being emperor and the head of the Tetrarchy and went back and farmed cabbages in the Adriatic. So, you know, he was an exception to the rule. Yeah, good for him. He was an exception to the rule. But, you know, you just had so much corruption everywhere that it became unmanageable. And it just set the conditions for poor economics. And then, you know, these corrupt officials, you know, it would create unrest and people would be unruly. And, well, that's just a tinderbox or a powder keg that's ready to go off for civil war. Oh, okay. Conditions are really bad here. I hate the administration. Let's make the general the emperor. Let's declare him emperor. We'll go fight somebody. Boom. And it just like that, it happens over and over again. So that's kind of where I make the argument that this loss of virtue, this loss of this disconnect to what they were as Romans, just laid the groundwork for everything else to occur. That was a bit of a tangent.
Yeah. No, it's good. It very much feels like the same is true for the U.S. Like it feels like our culture has shifted so much, like starting in the 1960s and to today, that we've kind of like sown the seeds of our own destruction. That's what it feels like. I'm not saying that's actually true.
That's we'll go through that on another episode. But yes, to your point, it feels like that exactly.
Yeah. And I almost feel like the Romans were also very much aware of this same like kind of slide. And, you know, like we talked about in our first episode, like once the, you know, there's this inertia that comes with decline that makes it really hard to get out of, even if you're able to recognize what the problems are.
Let's put it in today's terms. I mean, how many people trust their government? How many people trust a politician? Like, yeah. It's... There used to
approval ratings are usually pretty low, like in the 30, 30%.
And not only are they low, but if you know, just for the listeners out there, go out and just ask people what they think of a politician or what they think of somebody. And it's not even so much like a, yeah, I don't like this person because they voted this way. It's like they would all almost, it's ubiquitous to think of them as corrupt. Yeah. Like, and it crosses the aisle, full spectrum. Everybody, it's ubiquitous that politicians are in the pocket of somebody else or somebody else is lobbying and they're all corrupt. You know, that's really like Trump's big campaign. You know, that's how he got in as like an outsider. But, you know, like I used to follow this Twitter handle, it was Twitter back then, but they used to follow Nancy Pelosi's trades and it was insane how much money she was making in the stock market. And you're like, how does a public servant have millions and millions of dollars? How are you at 10,000% when everybody else is, you know, struggling, you know, just barely beating the index funds?
Because Congress exempts themselves from nearly every law they pass.
Interesting that, right? And so there's, there's, to your point, like there's just feels this certain cultural decline, and we know it's happening, but we can't seem to get the right people in charge to fix it and right the ship. And the more you look around, you lose confidence in other Americans that, like, hey, do you think we could fix it? Can we turn it around? Like, really, you know, you still see commercials out there from political campaigns like, yeah, we can save America. We're gonna fight for you, Joe Schmo oppressed or whatever. And then you kind of look at it and you're like, I don't know if I buy it. I don't know if, you know.
Yeah. So let's look at a specific example here in the United States that is remaining on the motif of like government corruption, right? In Rome, there was a Senate. Mm-hmm. The Senate was composed mostly of, you know, what we might think of as the nobility, right?
The elites.
Not the common people. Well,
that's
the elites, right?
Yeah, that's the pejorative term for today.
Right. The British saw this, and you know, we here in the United States get a lot of our political ideas from Great Britain. The British saw, and they have their House of Lords and a House of Commons, right? When we were going through our constitutional convention, said that we will have a Senate, right? And we will have a House of Representatives. And, you know, if our listeners want to go back to our series on political foundations here in the United States, we talk about how the House of Representatives here in the United States, every last one of them has to campaign for reelection every 2 years. Whereas for senators, it's a 6-year term. And 1/3 of the Senate is up for re-election at a time during that same, you know, every 2 years. The reason why the entire House of Representatives is up for re-election every 2 years is because our founding fathers, kind of, you know, jumping off from the foundation that the Brits gave us, looked back at the Roman Empire and they saw that when these, you know, elite senators just kind of stay in power forever, they naturally create a system that benefits themselves as opposed to what benefits everybody. So this House of Commons or this House of Representatives aspect is intended to be what is the federal political institution that is most closely aligned to the will of the people. We still had a Senate because we didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there is this idea. I mean, you know, I come from the rural South. I'll say that. I come from the rural South. There's a lot of people that, like, when Winston Churchill said the best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter, he was spot on. Like, there are some people that it's like, no, I actually kind of want an elite, somebody that actually knows what the freak they're talking about to govern and rule me. Like, there are benefits there. That's why we have
the noblesse oblige. Nobility, nobility obliges. Like, the idea that somebody who is from high birth, somebody who, like, let's be honest, there are people who have a very strong aptitude in political sense and a strong willpower to do things. Those people exist, and it's not a problem. They should be in charge. At the same time, nobility obliges. Like, if you have those gifts, you need to use them to better your fellow man who may not have that ability. And it's what's interesting. It's like, within the Roman emperors especially lost sight of this, completely lost sight of it. Mm. It became a power grab. And not only just like Roman emperors, but just the Roman bureaucracy in general. So, I mean, there was a Roman governor, provincial governors. And then when they decided that provincial governors couldn't take the army either because that was too much power, and they created what was called a dux, which became duke. So dukes actually trace their lineage back to Rome, who were in charge of military affairs. Like, they just lost touch with that kind of thought process of, I am in a high place, but because I'm in a high place, I have an obligation to those that I am in charge of. And you're right. Mm. It is a good thing to have that. Like, it's not a problem to have somebody who's very talented. That's what you want. You want the talented people making decisions. How's that working out for us now?
Yeah. So that's where I was going, was like, you can create the best system that human beings have ever created, which is a little bit of hyperbole. you know, it's too soon to tell. The American experiment is too soon to tell. You know, I'm sure our British listeners are laughing in British at us right now. And I will not try to do a British accent. I'm terrible for accents. But anyway, the point being is like, we've created a really good system. And look at the U.S. Congress right now. Like, the House of Representatives has been in chaos for the last several weeks. And we finally have a speaker. And this guy was basically pulled out of nowhere. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I frankly don't know enough about the guy. Well, I know that he was a part of the election, stolen election claims, which I do not support, but that's about the only thing that I know about the guy. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, we did everything we could to create a system modeled, you know, trying to learn from the lessons of the Romans that would be corrupt, and it's still not perfect. And it's still, like, going to be and is completely dysfunctional from time to time. And only time will tell if, you know, the recent developments in the House will show that it's going to get any better. And a lot of these people, like the Matt Gaetz and the Boberts and the AOCs and the squad people, like, you name it, on both sides of the aisle, they show up and they're like, I'm reflecting the will of the people, and they just make things worse. So I say all that to, like, kind of go back to the earlier comment about, like, there's this inertia that comes with civilizational decline. And even if you're operating in the right system, and even if you're trying to take the lessons that you learned from the Romans, it's really, really hard to get back to, okay, here's how we actually fix these problems. Here's how we address the corruption, etc.
I'm going to do a pop culture reference. So And this movie has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but in the movie, The Big Short, which is a fantastic movie. So good.
Great movie.
There's a scene, like, right before the Great Recession, like, truly kicks off. And I think they had just gone to Vegas. And, you know, it's a scene where Steve Carell's like, he's on the phone. He's like, there's a bubble, or, you know, whatever. And he's talking, you know, they kind of figure out that, like, there's a bubble. It's about to burst. And, like, they're calling everybody out and they're trying to raise awareness out of it. And some other people are there to make money. But, like, there's a scene where it kind of slows down and it shows, like, everybody dancing and having a good time. And then, like, the next scene, it's like, oh, and Bear Stearns just went out of, you know, just went bankrupt. Lehman Brothers just went bankrupt. Everybody lost billions of dollars. I kind of think, if you were to superimpose that scene over Rome and talking about this inertia, that's kind of how you have to see it, especially from a culture standpoint. Like, you have all of these great emperors, and I should say, like, there were good emperors during the imperial era. There were they who did have the nobility obliges, like Trajan, Nerva, Marcus Aurelius, Diocletian, Constantine. But there became an inertia underneath those good emperors that was almost undetectable until it was too late. And I think that's the part of the problem, is most people are not willing to do any kind of self-reflection and see it. The Romans didn't, because by the time it had gotten really bad and things started to truly decline and get out of hand, like in the 3rd century, it was too late. Like, how do you go back and how do you reinvigorate a culture that is lost, that is hundreds of years gone? How do you go back to those people that are bureaucrats in Britannia or, you know, Asia Minor and Egypt? How do you go to them and say, hey, gravy train's over. We're going to go back to, you're going to get back to this agrarian society. Nope. That's what Pertinax tried to do that. And he got executed really quick. He was assassinated very quickly. So that's what I mean. It's kind of like, it's too late. Once you realize, like, things are going downhill, like, Rome couldn't, I would contend that culturally speaking, Rome didn't have enough fight left in it to save itself as of Marcus Aurelius' death. Constantine was an amazing emperor. He actually, you know, he reunited it, you know, conquered the Tetrarchy. Diocletian kind of saved it. Aurelian was this reunited the 3 different empires that Rome split into, blah, blah, blah. Great emperors. Yeah. Aetius defeated the Huns 20 years prior, but they couldn't reverse what has already done. Like it was already slipping. And those men were honestly generational talents, like civilizational talents that just happened to line up kind of within the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would happen to much sooner. They really just delayed the inevitable at that point. Like once ETS, it's amazing. So once ETS was assassinated by Valentinian III, who in like 453, I think, who did it because he was jealous. He thought ETS was rising too quickly. That was like the last guy that would have saved that guy, that saved his skin and kept the Western Roman Empire in some semblance of order. Like you just defeated the Huns. The greatest threat you're going to face, the one guy who could kind of keep the peninsula together and maybe parts of Gaul, you just assassinated. And then you yourself get assassinated. Like he did it because he was jealous and wanted power. He did it. And then he got assassinated. If he had just had any foresight, any calling to a greater Rome to rebuild, he wouldn't have done it, but he didn't have that. Most of these emperors in late stage Rome, they just lacked that. They lacked the foresight and the unselfishness that it would take. Yeah. And so did the Roman people. They were having a good time. You know, it's interesting. I did read that it was like almost 550 AD that the last event at the Colosseum or the Hippodrome occurred in Rome. So even like 80 years after the fall of the Western Roman Empire, they were still keeping people entertained in the Colosseum.
Wow.
Like that's how, you know, numbed these people were to what was going on. So,
So I forget exactly what you just said that made me think of this. Maybe in the editing, you'll hear me gasp because that was when it occurred to me. But I really like your earlier, like, much earlier comment about how I'm going to butcher it, but it's like, it's not about, it was like tradition is not about preserving or not about worshiping ashes. It's about preserving a fire type deal. Mm-hmm. I think that if conservatives today want to actually like, you know, do the right thing, the focus should not be preserving the fire. It should be build a new fire.
Build the fire and, bigger.
So- right. Well, like, no, I specifically mean build a new fire.
Ooh.
Like as a posture, as an intent, as like a, like take the lessons learned, you know, that's why we're here at the Loins of History. Like take the lessons learned. You have to create something new. If you're not creating something new, you are already fighting a losing battle. And the United States is a perfect example of this. Like our founding fathers, when they drafted the Declaration of Independence, they didn't recreate an older version of British Parliament and have a monarchy. They created something completely new. And it was way better, if I may be so bold, it was way better. Way better.
Way better. Geez, I'm okay. Leaving that in. That's not getting edited out.
It's late at night, folks. It was way better than anything the Brits had come up with. And if the Brits disagree with me, you know, I would just say like, what's your GDP? and come at me when you cut that stat for me.
Your country went from a quarter of the world to smaller than Georgia.
We love our Brits. Anyway, gosh, I can't wait to hear all the hate and discontent that we get from that. Anyway. It's like they had to create something new. I think if conservatives here in America, we should not cede the ground of the future to progressives. Progressives are all about, like they come from this Marxist view of like, you know, the inevitable march of history is towards the workers' revolution. You know, that's the socialist bent. But like a lot of progressives come from that background where they're like, they're hyper-focused on the future, and they're explicitly trying to tear down what was in the past. Conservatives are automatically fighting a losing battle. We're never going to get the past back. Rather, we should be, like you were saying earlier, or what we were talking about earlier, we have to focus on the good things, like the things that we, that were successful in the past, whether that's from a religious standpoint or just from a, you know, objective, like, no, this is a good way of doing politics or a good way of doing business or something like that. And we have to take those things and create something new. That, you know, for the culture warriors out there, I think that's the way that, you know, that's the framework that we have to go if we actually want to do something good.
I tend to agree with that, but keeping it on the theme of Rome, connecting what you're saying, like speaking of creating something new.
Rome didn't do that, which is why they fell.
Rome didn't do that, yes, but somebody did. So within Rome, and I mentioned this is a key takeaway too, Gibbon blames like Christianity, and it's not like I don't think he truly hated Christianity, but he blamed them. And I want to add some context to that. So part of the reason he like puts the blame on Christianity for the fall of Rome was it pulled Christians out of this, as he would say, like a traditional Roman culture of like, well, serving in the military and like worshiping their ancestors and or paying homage to their ancestors and their gods and like being Romans first, like putting Rome above all else, whereas they worshiped God above everything else. And that was like very foreign to them. As a matter of fact, Romans in the early church, and this is the thing like that gets me when people talk about like Western history and like Christianity being oppressive, like when Christianity spread in Rome, it was the religion of women and slaves. Like women and slaves were the ones that looked at Christianity and they were like, yes, this is what we want. Rome did not like it at all. They hated it. I mean, they persecuted him for hundreds of years before Constantine. Like it was so foreign to anything else in the world at the time, completely foreign. And that's why like women and slaves latched onto it, and it created like a separate identity. And so this separate identity began to slowly and then very rapidly pull a lot of people away from Roman values, quote unquote. And, you know, at the time post-resurrection of Jesus, there's, you know, at this point you're already in Imperial Rome, but where am I going with this? Anyway, culture's already declining, so they've already kind of moved away from the Republic, but like it still pulled other people further out of what could have been like a Rome first type of culture, and they became Christians and they started separating themselves. Like, you know, the Jesus fish you see and all of these other things, like those are all like Christian symbols, and Christians were persecuted, but they were in hiding. So they pulled away from Roman society, and then they grew and they grew and they grew and they grew and they kept growing. And they didn't want to go fight necessarily all of these Roman civil wars. They didn't want to participate in all of these Roman events. They were very different. They separated themselves. So I would like to caveat, Gibbon kind of blames them. I would say like had Rome embraced Christian values sooner than Constantine, say like Marcus Aurelius or Trajan, they wouldn't have had a lot of the problems that they had later. That's just my argument, because the Christians of Rome were not known to be like hedonistic criminals, like a lot of was occupying the upper echelons of Roman society at the time. So I think that that almost would have been a step closer to a traditional Roman value. But the Romans at the time decided that they wanted to squash Christianity and force them out. So Christians separated, and eventually they grew to like critical mass and became the Roman Empire became Christian. And at that point, like this new identity, so people stopped, you know, Christians at this point now had their own identity to follow and believe in. And, you know, the Roman Catholic Church was born out of that. So I just want to make that point that they kind of separated and created something new versus, you know, causing the Roman downfall at the time. I think Rome caused its own downfall because they were so anti-Christian that instead of just incorporating or building a new fire, like you just said, with those Christian values, they chose to try and extinguish this one. You're on mute.
They tried to Klingon.
They tried to Klingon.
They tried to Klingon. Yeah. They tried to cling on to whatever, to something that they thought was good. And it wasn't until Constantine that they tried to incorporate what it would look like for the Roman Empire to adapt and improve, which, and oh, by the way, like, it wasn't smooth sailing after Constantine either. Like,
no, there's Julian the Apostate that came later, like 60 years later, I think, or so. You know, it's interesting that you just said, like, they did, they tried to cling on. You know, the thing that they were clinging to was not like a genuine Roman Republic idealized culture. It was, they were clinging to all of the like benefits of having that culture versus like the actual root and the fundamental. And that kind of goes back to my point about like football. It's like, we're clinging to like, yes, I'm a Dolphins fan. Yes, I'm a fan of this band. Like, all of those things are byproducts of a, of an underlying culture, like a deeply rooted. Everything we enjoy now is because of that culture that existed a long time ago that built all this up. So we don't need to cling to like, oh, I want to watch a pro football game. It's like, hey, what made, you know, what allowed us to have these pro football games? I'm going to cling to that so we can continue to have it. Bro. And that's just a silly example, but that's the thing. That's what Romans were clinging to. Oh, well, the good of the empire. Well, what does that mean if you got, if you're constantly at war with yourselves? What does that mean?
I'm really going to offend some people. I don't know why this episode. I swear I'm a nice guy. I'm not trying to offend people. Take that same line of thought, and we're going to apply that to our Antebellum South episode.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. Get ready.
The hate mail is going to come.
Oh, man. People trying to cling on to something that it's like, oh, this allows me to live the life that I want to live. And if I no longer have this thing, then all of a sudden, like, the entire social fabric of my society differs or changes. And now, like, everything gets to change. Therefore, let's just hang on a little bit longer, a little bit longer, a little bit longer. Yeah. Fun.
Can't wait for that one.
Yeah, we're gonna hurt some feelings. I'm gonna hurt some feelings on that one. Anyway, all right.
So I think that we're coming to a close on this episode, and we talked about a lot of different things, but one of the things we haven't mentioned over the last three episodes is like, how did the Western Roman Empire actually end? Like, what was the event that occurred? And it's funny, like, you see in pop culture a lot of these like paintings of like the sack of Rome, and they're very dramatized, and they're just, the buildings are on fire, and there's barbarians running through the streets, raping and pillaging. But the truth is, as great as the Roman Empire was, like, it went out with a whimper, not a bang, not a great siege.
Yeah.
Rome was sacked in 410 by the Goths, the Visigoths, and then again, 50 years later, 45 years later, by the Vandals. And then, you know, you had a bunch of shadow emperors, and their capital was actually in Ravenna. And in 476, a 14-year-old who was crowned king or emperor of Rome, what was left of it, which was basically Ravenna, Rome, and like a little bit of Cisalpine Gaul, named Romulus Augustulus. He was emperor for a few months, and an Ostrogoth king or general at the time, who had served in the Roman army, actually basically walked up, said, "You're not the emperor anymore," took the purple and sent it to the Eastern Roman Empire, and deposed Romulus Augustulus and sent him into exile. And that was it.
Wow.
That was for 1100 years, the power, the apex of Western history went out with a 14-year-old basically being told, "Go live in exile. You're not the emperor anymore," by then King, I've heard Odoacer and Udoacer as the pronunciations. And that was it. You know, there was a guy named Nespos the Nose who, like, quote unquote, ruled Rome from the Adriatic, but he was eventually assassinated, I think, in 480. But for all intents and purposes, 476 was the end of the Western Roman Empire. Yeah. And that's how it ended. Quietly, just went into the night. They didn't rage into the night. They just went quietly.
Right. I think that should humble all of us that, you know, you could have a 1,000-year empire and it still ends. And there's no guarantees that you know, the towers and the fortresses and the institutions that we build are going to last forever.
They'll just be ruins that people walk through and marvel at.
Yeah.
It is. It's very humbling.
That should humble us for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure the Brit that I was hypothetically talking to earlier when I made my GDP comment was like, it's going to happen to y'all too. Maybe, and maybe so, but
not today.
Not today. Man, that's a great Aragorn Gondor.
But it is not this day.
It is not
this
day.
Today we fight. We need to do like a Lord of the Rings. I don't know. That would be pretty fun.
Yeah. On our last episode of The Fall of Civilizations, we're going to do Gondor.
No, we need to do Numenor.
Dude, I can't wait till Rings of Power comes back out. Why? Whoever made the decision to do like a 2-year gap between seasons 1 and 2, I hate you. Yeah, I don't know.
You're the only Tolkien fan that is probably excited about that.
That's not true. That's not true. It is so much better than what people give it.
We're doing a watch along series for the Rings of Power, just so because it'll be extremely contentious.
Yeah, I will say your Lord of the Rings knowledge is infinitely superior to mine, so it will not be a fair fight. However,
enjoy it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. All right. You want me to close this out?
Yeah, close this out.
Well, on that fun and positive note, we hope all of y'all enjoyed this episode. If you like what we're doing, the most helpful thing that you can do to support our podcast is not actually to give us money. Instead, it is to give us a 5-star review on the platform that you're listening to us. If it's YouTube, to like and subscribe. If you're on Apple or Google, Podcast Addict, Spotify, any of those things, just click the 5 stars. That really goes a long way to help us out and get the algorithm to recommend us to your friends. Also, you can share the podcast with our folks. Give us some feedback. You can leave a comment. Both Colin and I are fairly responsive, or at least we try to be. And in responding to y'all, we take constructive feedback and we try to incorporate it. You leave us a 5-star review and a comment, we'll give you a shout out episode here on our next episode. We love doing that for those of y'all that are doing it. You can follow us. We're on Instagram, Facebook, X. You can follow us and get the latest updates on there. And with that, look forward to next week starting our Fall of the Han Dynasty little series. We'll talk about a completely different culture, but roughly around the same time as the Roman Empire, and see what happened with them. So with that, we will see y'all next week on the Loins of History.